welcome to the Amber Spycast, your one-stop shop for all things His Dark Materials.
I've seen this movie a few times. I'm watching, I was like, oh, right. They're not going to Ballvinger yet. They're going to Svalbard. We're going to have this whole scene with Ragnar, by the way.
Oh, my God. Ragnar. What? Why?
Why? This is because they said that it would confuse the audience to have two characters with names that start with I.
Who's spelling the names while they watch the movie?
I don't know. Yofor and Yorick. I guess they're somewhat similar. Man. This was the whole Asha Osha thing from Game of Thrones, too. You know, that people couldn't deal with that. So we go to see Ragnar and another Ian delivering some significant vocal work here. Ian McShane. Yeah, Ian this McShane. Time. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's a strong choice, too.
That's I thought it was voice. Great. Oh, no, it was great. And the physical difference.
But he's big.
Yeah. And the physical, it was just perfect. Like, I fell in love with Ian McShane watching Deadwood. Just, you know, watching him in that show, I was just like, you're the worst amazing person I've ever met. Like, he was fantastic. And I love it because that rough, that gruff, you know, all of that fit who, I can't call him Ragnar, but well, yeah, I guess Ragnar in the movie, but who Yofor was. And, you know, that more noble, more classy, more true bear, it, you know, Ian McKellen fit that so well. Mm-hmm. I did not like that they had, and I know they did it for tension and they did it to make this fight seem more meaningful. But I hated that they had that Yorick was defeated in combat the first time by Ragnar.
Yes.
And I was like, why? Why do that? Why? Because I don't see the point in that.
She gets the alethiometer out right in front of him. Like, yeah. What are you doing?
Yes.
Like, this is a secret. This is something you're using this to sort of describe your demon powers. And she's like, mm-hmm. it's a tool that demons use. Are you kidding me?
Right. Yeah. The bit with the fight and how he supposedly defeated him was extremely disappointing to me.
Thumbs down.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I kept waiting to find out that Ragnar had drugged Yofor. I mean, right. Yorick, excuse me, you know?
Nope.
And had defeated him that way.
Nope.
I would have accepted that.
Defeated him and then banished him. That's it, I guess. That's it.
Ridiculous.
It was. Totally.
His totally ridiculous. His human demon, pretty good.
Yeah, that was creepy looking.
I was really looking, you know, they were kind of zooming over to it, and I was like, ooh, what's it going to look like? And yeah, it's pretty freaky looking.
Yeah, yeah.
That was creepy. And that's where she gets her idea. That was sort of telegraphed pretty well, that little bit where she gets the idea. And she kind of has a line where she says something similar to the book, which is, you know, oh, I've done something bad and Yorick's going to come here and this is going to be, you know, it's not good for him and he's going to die. You know, I liked how that played out, or how Pan had to hide. All that stuff was still pretty much there. But she just, you know, the way that they do it is she just shows up. It's like, you know, she gets just delivered to the bear. I mean, it's like so underwhelming.
Yeah.
The whole thing
literally wrote that in my, I wrote underwhelming in my notes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh,
five.
Yeah. this is how we should get. Okay. Okay, I guess.
And then, they didn't even play up the fact, like, part of the reason you would show the doll is because he wants to be human. And he wants a demon. Sure. But they did nothing to really show the degradation of the bears at all. And maybe they felt that wasn't necessary, but it just made it for such a flat, you know, I mean, the armor was like the only thing that was, you know, where you saw any kind of a difference in like what the, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, and maybe the throne, I don't know, whatever throne he was sitting on. I'm not really sure if that's how the throne would have looked for other, you know, another bear, but you know, there wasn't any of that at all.
We're in Svalbard for 5 minutes before Yorick rolls up for the fight. It's really that short.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's so telegraphed. And then Yurik runs up. They do have kind of a good scene together, as mm-hmm. as I think you guys were saying, with his vocal performance is very good, and he does have mm-hmm. some tenderness for, and he almost kind of chuckles at like mm-hmm. the deception that she's played, and that's when he calls her Silver Tongue. That all worked great.
It did.
And then the fight is actually pretty good too.
The fight was pretty awesome.
It's pretty killer, and kind of plays out just like maybe a little bit tighter, but kind of plays out the same way. It's like, oh my God, yeah.
I'll be honest, I was a little shocked when he slapped Ragnar's face off.
Me too. For some reason, did not remember it the first time I saw that movie. And I was sitting with Jack, he's 9, and we both were like, whoa. I was like, it just goes like flying across the screen. That would have been great now in like 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Annika had put a stuffed animal, her stuffed Darth Vader, by the way, in front of her face because she didn't want to watch the bears fight.
Oh, okay.
She was upset watching the bears fight. And then Candace and I kind of jumped. It's like, oh my God. And he knocked his face off. And Annika like pulls the Vader down. And she's like, what was it? What happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. He hit him really hard.
And he grabs his neck and like
he does
and throws him down.
Exactly. Didn't yank out his heart though.
No, he didn't. Although that would have been killer.
But he does yell, "Bears, who is your king?"
Yeah.
And I was glad to hear it, but I would have loved for him to have said that after he was eaten the heart.
Yeah.
Side note. Oh, sorry.
No, please. Go ahead.
I'm in my class, in my middle school class this week. I'm teaching narrative technique to my students. And one of the things we talked about was descriptive detail. And they were all falling asleep in their chair. And I was like, hey, I do this podcast. And last week we talked about this part. And then I just went into all the detail, all of it. Jaw off, tongue lolling, ripping. And they were all like, what? And then I yelled, bears. And they were all into it. And I said, now you see, I said, if you don't feel this way after you read a book, they are not doing a very good job of their descriptive detail.
That's right.
And it was awesome. They were all, and they're like, what book is that, Miss Martinez? What book is, they all want to read it. And I was like, no. You're middle grade and I don't want to be responsible for you reading that with your parents. So I will not tell you the name of it.
You can discover it on your own.
That's right. You can figure it out. But it is, that's a great scene.
It was. I wasn't disappointed by the fight. Like I said, I enjoyed the fight. The way they did Lyra's big lie, like, you know, if I were making the movie, one of those critiques, but if I were making the movie, you know, I would have played up that the lie that she told about being the demon of because everything that she said was like the culmination of all of the information that she'd kind of picked up throughout the rest of the movie. Right.
And she doesn't have any of that information to go off of.
Exactly. And it kind of just happens.
She sees that he's holding the doll.
She remembers that somebody told.
But no one told her that because the party never happened.
They did. Mrs. Coulter said it.
Mrs. Coulter did. Yes.
Oh, that's right. They gave her that line, didn't they? Again, let's give her this line to spit. It's so cheap.
Yeah, it was just tagged in just so it would fit later on.
Hmm. Well, and part of it was. But part of it, too, was the way for her to say, I'm telling you something special because you're my special girl. And do you know what I mean? Like, it was also a way for her, like, well, you can't tell anybody that, but I trust you. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, in that sense, I can see, like, it didn't sit with me as necessarily a tag online. I felt like it served one of the, you know, the purpose for drawing Lyra in looks, in words, in action, like all those things. So, I mean, I didn't, it's still probably cheap, but not as cheap as, like.
And it could have, you know, I see your point. Again, oh my gosh, you're so persuasive.
Should have been a lawyer, darn it.
You should have.
Stupid teacher.
But yeah, I do see your point because had she not, you know, when she said it with the understanding that Lyra wasn't going to tell anybody, because at that point she probably wasn't going to take her north. So who was she going to tell? You know, how was that ever going to be useful to her?
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of feel like they should have played up the whole Lyra putting together all the pieces before she came up with her big lie. story at the end. Cause I mean, that's kind of her finishing move, you know, like she comes up with this big thing that gets it going that we all know is a lie. We know she's not a demon. So, you know, kind of make this a really powerful moment for Lyra. Like, you know, she's not going to get to knock somebody's face off. Thank God. Mm-hmm. Show us, give us a Lyra moment, you know, and that would have been it.
Yeah, as much as the bear fighting sequence works, so much of the rest of that stuff doesn't work. Again, they just blow through it.
Right. What it does then is Travis, it turns Lyra's intelligence and, you know, ability to think quickly and you know, all these things that are special about her, and it turns it kind of into dumb luck.
Yeah.
And then it defeats the, like, it takes away all the things that make her, you know, they even say in the beginning, Matt, do you think she's the child? Like, she's mm-hmm. the one? Like, they're even setting her up as this, you know, chosen one. Could it be her? But then everything that happens, there's nothing that's then innately part of who she is or part of that larger idea of destiny and free will. It's just like, oh, I happen to remember that.
Yeah. I mean, because I feel like that whole free will, which again is not explored in the movie really at all. But I mean, the whole Lyra's whole like lying thing, the whole silver tongue thing is, the whole principle of free will kind of lives through that, right? Like, she's making her own world every time she makes up one of these stories. She is, you know, she's the manifestation of free will, and they just kind of gloss over it. It's sad.
Yeah,
it is a missed opportunity. Again, hopefully this longer form that we're going to get in a couple of months will be able to address some of that stuff and really give us some meat to chew on.
Mm-hmm. Some seal meat.
Ooh, yeah, some dry seal meat. We talk a little bit about the Billy Costa switched for Tony reveal.
Yeah.
This didn't really work for me either. And considering that Ma Costa is very much a side character that doesn't get a lot to do, the fact that they swap Billy in, I guess to give it more weight, perhaps, that it's not a stranger, It doesn't really play. He gets returned. We don't know that he dies, right? That never is mentioned. He's just very broken, and Ma Costa is like, we'll find Ratter, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then that it is sort of chilling when they find him, and Pan, I think, really sells that scene right when he's going to open. I thought that was very accurate and kind of terrifying. Mm-hmm. But this fishing house is, again, by itself. There's no other house. It's not a village at all. There's nobody else around. And I thought that added to some of the terror of that mm-hmm. scene, is everyone was terrified of this kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she just happened to, you know, run up and go into this, you know, she found this kid, and there he was, a severed child. And she says she's going to help him and whatever. I don't really know why they did that. We do, on the way to get to Billy, we get the first chance to see Lyra ride Urich.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I thought that was pretty kind of thrilling. It was kind of thrilling.
I wrote, I have a newfound respect for her riding him. I was like, I wrote, ouch.
Yeah.
I could not imagine. Like, he is just trucking.
Yeah.
And she, I'm thinking, your poor haunches.
Oh man, she's holding on tight.
I know, like, mm-hmm. I'm just gonna be so sore tomorrow morning. but it was cool to watch. It was cool to watch that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point they kind of were one in the way they were moving, and mm-hmm. it certainly sold the connection
mm-hmm.
in some way for them. Yeah.
So let's jump to Ballvengar. What do we think about how that place was designed?
You mean jump to Ballvengar just like the movie did?
Just like the movie did.
It was neat, I suppose.
The little severing machine was pretty cool.
The severing machine, I thought, was that whole thing with the severing machine was exactly from the book.
Yeah.
I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I thought that worked pretty well, too. Mm-hmm. It's funny, the when Lyra goes back to destroy the machine, you get to see some of the buttons a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole section that's just like faders on a like a sound like a
right,
soundboard.
Right,
she's,
right.
She like runs all the faders on the soundboard. It's like, oh, it's gonna be loud.
She turned them up to 11.
Yeah. So that was kind of funny. The so she gets to Ballfinger and she gets taken in, I guess, immediately into the you're just in time for whatever meal they were serving. And she sees the kids, not as many kids. It's a smaller, much smaller room, mm-hmm. many, many fewer kids than from the book. But they did have the palm tree on the wall.
They did.
Which I thought was a nice touch. And they do have kind of a moment where the Pan and Roger's demon, they sort of jump on each other, and Roger looks at him and she's like, but they're still playing on the floor, which I thought was a little bit of a misstep. The demons should have been more careful. Demons not as careful in the movie. Mm-hmm. Demons kind of do whatever they do. So she does get a chance to chat with Roger a little bit. Roger he's an interesting looking kid. I can't really decide what it is about him, but I was like, man, this kid is a really unusual looking kid.
Yeah. As I read the book, I rate him as a Ron Weasley type, you know?
Yeah. This kid was tiny. He's so
tiny.
Small.
Yeah.
He's easily a head shorter than Lyra.
Yeah. Right.
So how does she end up under the table listening, eavesdropping?
Well, Roger or Billy take her to that room to look for something. And then
this was
as Mrs. Coulter is showing up.
Yeah.
And then Mrs. Coulter's, you know, snacks happen to be there.
Yes.
That's where they take her. And then they happen to have the meeting there. Mm-hmm. There's no agency in that scene. You know, it's right. There's no Lyra isn't directing her own.
It's like, oops, here. I ended up in this place and now I'm going to eavesdrop. I just whoops.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, she gets caught. Mrs. Coulter is out of the room at this point, but she gets caught and like, okay, let's go cut her, which is kind of accurate in the sense that when she was discovered in the ceiling, they decided to do it just to shut her up. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel the same because of how sort of matter of fact it is that she's even under the table to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even think that where she was under the table would have really hid her very well.
Right.
So they grab her and they drag her to the machine. And this was pretty harrowing.
It was.
And the guy grabs Pan, and that was sort of, it kind of makes her faint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She like passes out. It's so upsetting. She comes to relatively quickly, but it's sort of like that upsetting. That effect didn't really work. He's obviously not holding anything.
Yeah.
It was a pretty weak effect.
Yes.
So they slap him in the machine. They run the faders up to 11. And that thing gets this close to being completely down.
Yeah, I had a little
to the slow motion Mrs. Coulter.
Slow-mo, like, okay, yep.
This thing is this close.
Yeah.
She yells to stop. She lifts the thing, but it doesn't stop that center thing from coming down. So I'm not really sure because they cut away. You know, you don't really get to see what's happening to Lyra. You only see Mrs. Coulter's reaction to it and how upset she is. Mm-hmm. But Nicole Kidman plays the hell out of that scene.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
You see the terror. She does not want to intersize Lyra.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay. And then she has this talk about Captain Exposition. She's got so much exposition the next scene when Lyra wakes up. It's like, man, she must have 12 pages of dialogue. It was like,
well, it's all the stuff that Lord Osriel's supposed to say at his house.
Oh, my God.
She's so saying in the scene.
Everything. It's like somebody on the set was like, Nicole, here's the book. Can you read this? You know, it's like she says so much stuff, spits out so much stuff. And Lyra's just, you know, just can't stand her. You know, it's like so just ugh. She already wasn't feeling her anyway. But man, she's just over her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's a really cheap shot of the movie to try to make. And I wrote it in my notes like a sympathetic Mrs. Coulter. No. Like, you don't get to all of a sudden. Now, we talked about this. We didn't really get into it, but like a little bit earlier, she's can't find Lyra. She's looking at the picture of Lyra. Monkey gets eared, like jealous, slaps it out of their hand or puts it, you know, like kind of puts it down. And Mrs. Coulter slaps her demon.
Slap the badness out of that demon.
She shocked the monkey for sure.
She sure did.
Yes. But she, I mean, you know, and I actually thought that was a really good.
That was a cool addition.
I did. I and really then
the,
liked
the
it.
Handprint the handmark, on her face.
Yes. I thought it was great for like showing how they were separate, but you know, they still were connected and, but it was still this showing a deeper feeling than she really has in the book.
That she really cared about. It's like, again, right. She's so distanced from her. This exposition where she says, I wasn't able to have you, you know, but now because I have power, I can, now I can have you back. It really doesn't play.
I need you guys to help me out with that whole slapping the monkey thing, which slap I promise to the monkey. Audience is not a euphemism. What? Okay. I guess part of it was like a self-loathing thing.
Like, why would she slap the monkey?
Why would she slap the monkey? Like, it's when it's obvious. I mean, it's like slapping your own hand.
Well, Lyra is her daughter. So she is sort of, I think, letting us know that she still loves her or cares about her. Or maybe she has affection for her and how important a daughter or a child can be to you. And the demon in this world, and we've sort of talked about how this would work, is the demon is maybe closer to you than your own children are.
Mm-hmm.
And and she's showing some affection for Lyra in this scene.
But the demon is her.
Part of her, yes. Part of her.
It is. And, you know, I mean, it's like a limb. I mean, it's like a self-aware limb.
Well, people cut themselves and pinch themselves, and you know, I think it.
So
could,
is that what we were seeing?
Like self harm.
There was some self. It's not like she didn't know that was going to hurt her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's maybe that scene also has a little bit of like bipolar kind of like she slaps mm-hmm. him and then kind of like snaps right out of it. It's almost like she slapped herself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It literally slapped herself, like kind of snapped herself out of it.
You know.
Then she's comforting him.
Now that you when you were talking about the self-harm thing, though, that kind of spoke to me here. Like, I wonder if, you know, she's done this. She does that regularly. Does she abuse it?
Maybe that's what's made him so terrible.
That's why it's mute.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, especially if you're thinking about the screenwriter who wrote that scene, they probably didn't think that hard about it. We're probably thinking harder about it than the screenwriter did, but in the context of people that are appreciators of the source material, you could dig into that quite a bit about how and why she would do it. And I think it kind of is sort of consistent with her character.
I think so too.
I think that is a pretty good pull. That could fit right in the book and I wouldn't think it was out of place.
Not at all. Not at all.
So she almost gets intercised. She spends some time with Mrs. Coulter, who's sort of like yammering. And we do see a little bit of that softer side of her. But then she's sort of comforting her, and then she whispers that, in Jordan College, you were given something that wasn't really supposed to be given to you. Mm-hmm. And then you know, okay, this whole thing is leading up to this moment where she basically wants this thing. This is her last scene in the movie, too. Like, she's passed out for the rest of the scene. So this is, like, her moment. And Lyra has sort of she has the Spyfly tin that has – it's been whacked. I guess the wax has sealed it up, you know. And she just willingly hands it over, backs over the door. This is that, you know, backing into the hedges moment from the book. Very similar. Yep. It plays that very similar. She's, like, standing there watching it. Away. And it plays out pretty well. I like how the monkey takes and sort of, you know, Mrs. Coulter isn't doing it fast enough. And the monkey's like, ah, it just like rips all the stuff off of it. And they do the peek and you hear the thing flapping around. I thought that worked out pretty well. And then it knocks Mrs. Coulter out.
Right.
And then Lyra beats, you know, it runs out the door. So I'm not sure how it all, that thing just like flapping around in there. I'm not sure what happens. But this is the moment in the book where she would have pulled the fire alarm and sort of had a plan in place. Instead, she just causes an explosion. Instead of burning the kitchen, she blows up the machine.
Right.
She throws a metal box into the MRI of
and
the thing goes,
it's also it's like a gravity element to that thing, which is really weird.
Well, I wasn't looking at it as gravity. Like I said, I was looking at like an MRI where you put like a piece of metal in there.
Oh, it's like kind of magnetic. Yeah. There's something weird about that. So, and that thing explodes like crazy. I'm surprised it didn't kill her, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's like it's huge concussive explosion. Then all the kids bolt out. We don't get any of the bit to see. We don't see where the demons are. All that stuff has been cut out. Mm-hmm. But the kids running out and coming upon the Tartars with their dogs and wolves, or their wolves.
Mm-hmm. They're wolves.
That was right out of the book. Right out of the book.
Yep.
Yeah.
Standing there, facing them off. Lyra stepping forward. And then Yurik rolls up, our hero, mm-hmm. and starts just whack-a-mole. It's just, this is like dust everywhere. People are getting wiped out. I did have a little bit of a mental note where I'm like, every single shot is a mortal shot. If someone's hit with an arrow, their demon dies immediately.
Yeah.
So that means they had to have died instantly from getting an arrow in their heart or their brain, I guess. So I think if you're thinking that you have to die for your demon to disappear, that the whole I think only maybe Yurik smashing people, that was the one where you could see those things disappearing. Right. But I think that the fact that anytime anyone was hit with an arrow, their demon disappeared right away, or shot with a gun, their demon disappeared right away. It's kind of, that was a little, I didn't think that through. It right. rung false for me.
I guess they couldn't do those Saving Private Ryan type scenes where you had the demon the trying to scoop the guy's, intestines back in, like we heard about.
We're about to get this on HBO, so maybe they'll add that.
It may be.
I wonder if this is a TVMA. There's no way, right?
I don't know.
It's got
to
be.
I really want the kids to watch it, but at the same time, if we've got... I can't imagine at least like the first few episodes would be. There can't be anything.
No, I mean, even if they did everything that was in the book, I can't imagine there's anything that's going to be that inappropriate.
Yeah.
I can't either. Even the violence, like, most violent thing is...
The jaw.
Yeah,
kids have already seen it at this point.
Yeah,
and the heart,
and the ripping of the throat. They
definitely need to add that back in.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
please,
for sure.
And then there's a scene in The Subtle Knife that I'm like, how are they going to do that if they decide to do that? The one that Lin-Manuel Miranda tweeted about. Anyway, so there's a big battle. Mm-hmm. I kind of the whole thing where they trapped Yurik with grappling hooks, and then Lee kind of flies in and he shoots mm-hmm. the guys and he shoots the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay. It was okay. There was some of that stuff was like this heroic ending to the movie, and knowing that they don't go any further, it's okay. Kind of a climactic battle.
Lee is at Machina.
Oh my god!
For real.
Exactly. So this battle ends and we're victorious. Lyra decides that she's going to, this is kind of weird actually. The battle is won, I think, for the most part,
mm-hmm.
but she and Roger just walk over to Lee's balloon, leave everybody else behind. They have no goodbye and they don't say anything to them. They just go to the balloon and then cut. They're laying down on Yurik,
mm-hmm.
in the balloon, and Serafina and Lee are having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the both of them.
That
worked. But then they sort of decide that they're going to go to see Lord Asriel.
Mm-hmm.
And then they float into the sunset with a couple gas bags. That's it.
Yeah. Well, my wife asked me, well, what happened next? It's like, the Egyptians just slaughtered everybody in Valvanger. Then the little boy gets his soul ripped out and dies. Other than that, it's
not much. Not much.
No big deal.
So I'll put this on the Facebook page and we'll tweet it. But someone lovingly recreated the ending of this movie, which includes a lot of scenes that they shot for the movie but ended up in the video game only, and includes some significant final special effects looks for the ripping through the fabric between the two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the scenes of Mrs. Coulter and Lord Asriel kissing and Lyra screaming. And there's all kinds of stuff that was shot and was there.
But no demon, no demon, demon.
No demon.
No, no demon. I know you. I know you were disappointed, Travis.
I yeah.
Aren't we all?
You know.
That would have been an ending for sure.
That would have been.
Gross.
I was so the movie had a somewhat tepid response at the box office here in America. There was a significant an active boycott by the Catholic Church. It ended up making $70 million domestic, but it made a ton of moolah overseas. It made $300 million internationally alone, and $372 million worldwide. It made $70 million in America, only $70 million in America. And what is so fascinating about the business of how this played out? So New Line Cinema made this, and they were really expecting it to be a trilogy, and so they invested $180 million into it, which is a lot of dough. Mm-hmm. But America didn't play well, and that ended up even though it made $372 million worldwide, New Line sold the overseas rights. So none of the overseas money went to New Line. So New Line only made $70 million from this. I don't know how much they sold the distribution rights overseas. It's not very clear. But that ultimately was what did the movie in, did the sequels in. This played relatively well. There's a Variety article that talks about that not only was a success, it was a staggering success overseas. So there is a real interest in this material, certainly overseas. But two of the high-profile people who pushed the boycott, as a Baptist minister and a Catholic, someone high in the Catholic Church, were interviewed saying just how successful their boycott was and how thrilled they were that the film failed, because they didn't want kids to want to end up reading the books and finding out what happens.
Right.
Kids don't need free will.
No.
No. So you're telling me that the same version of this movie overseas...
$300 million.
Well,
$300 million.
This version, though.
This exact same movie.
I mean, did they also, when they got the rights, get all the extra footage and put it back in or something?
Chris Weitz says he has been wanting to do the director's cut and put everything back into it for like a DVD release, but New Line has so far not done that, not been willing to do that. Maybe we'll see it now. I don't know.
Huh.
I kind of doubt that. I know they're pulling it from Netflix as of October 1st.
Hmm.
I'm guessing it's to prevent there being any confusion between the movie and the TV series.
Makes
sense.
So
my guess is that this is going to go away.
Probably right.
Hmm.
I think the Catholic gentleman you're talking about is Bill Donahue.
That's right.
Who's responsible for a whole lot of... boycotts in the early 2000s, late 90s. I remember he led a boycott against Dogma as well.
That's right. There, Kevin Smith has a great story about when he went to his local movie theater to protest Dogma, and he made a sign to protest his own movie, and he got interviewed by the local news media, and his sign said, "Dogma is dog blank." Was his sign, and it was really bad. He did it with like a Sharpie on a piece of cardboard. But yeah, that you're right. That's exactly who it was. I read up a little bit on him, and he sounds like a real treasure.
Yeah, he's the best.
So, overall, a significant misfire. A lot of mistakes were made. I think a lot of it was part of it was this sort of the nerves, you know, this. We get Magisterium, but we don't, it's sort of, they're trying to be careful not to talk about the church, even though it's so obviously the church. Part of Mrs. Coulter's truth bomb that she drops includes an exact definition of Adam and Eve. You know, she basically talks about Adam and Eve.
Our ancestors.
Yes. That's right.
So there's kind of like, okay. But I think it's done in by harsh edits, nerves, confusion about what the material really was, an expectation that they would be making movies, the next movies, and hurting the first movie by sort of pushing things to the next movie. I don't know how much better the movie would be if it had 30 more minutes in it and what those 30 minutes entail, but I know some of it is the actual opening of the portal, and maybe they cut out that beginning thing because they don't need it.
Well, if they had the extra 12 minutes that we got tagged onto the end there from the game, that would have worked out nicely.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing we did miss among the mustache twirlers in the beginning of the movie, Christopher Lee.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Count Dracula himself.
I mean, my Jack said, "Mommy, is that Count Dooku?" And I was like, "Yep."
Yes, it is.
I mean, no, but yes.
Annika said, "Is that Willy Wonka's dad?"
Oh. It's like Isengard. Yeah,
exactly.
That's right. Is that Saruman? Yes.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I mean, a lot of great voices in this. You know,
yeah.
It's a good cast. It's a very good cast. I mean,
it really is. It was that, just
that's
it was,
the success.
Yeah, it was poor writing, editing mm-hmm. choices.
Mm-hmm.
Because even overall, the look of the film, I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There were some little cheesy things. And of course, looking back, some of the effects, you're like, you know, like the little taxi with the whirly thing. I was like, that's kind of silly.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it, I thought that those things yes. really actually, right? I was like, woo.
That looks so expensive too. Just for this.
I was like, God. Is somebody like pedaling in there? Or like, what is making that move?
And it was like, wow, 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 wow. Yes. It made a really weird sound. Yeah, six hamsters. They were all demons. They had six.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, they were all demons.
All demons.
Oh, man.
I do. I mean, it certainly was not the ability of the actors. Sometimes you just have bad actors. They didn't.
No.
The effects were nice. The you know, the cinematography, all those things, designs were nice. It just was really just poor.
Oh, yeah. Azrael's capture.
What? I had it. I know.
Wandering around in the snow.
Oh, my God.
So stupid.
Hey guys, can we talk about this? Well, no, can we talk about this like gentlemen? Like, come on.
You know, it's like, what? And then it also diminishes the fact that he's been banished by the bears are really overseeing his banishment. And then, God, that was terrible. And it was so corny and goofy. And like, what is he doing? He doesn't have anything with them. They're just walking in the middle of the snow.
No, it's and then they're running in those little crevices. I kept hearing like the Benny Hill theme as they were like running, like doo 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 doo. And they just kept running through all these little things. I'm like, what is going on?
If any listener has those kind of skills, could you do that for us, please? Add that Benny Hill theme to that sequence. I'd really appreciate it.
That should have been a deleted scene.
That absolutely. So should have been a deleted scene.
I was perfectly fine with that being off camera.
So could we close this out just by talking about the feedback question that we got?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah.
Let's do it. It's a very, very good question.
Yes.
Pull up Mr. Kenneth's email just a sec. Why is reloading it? There we go. Just for the crowd, when I got this today, I sent a quick note to Alaric and Joanna shouting, you know, we got one, like I was Janine from Ghostbusters. I was so excited. But this is from Kenneth Gillespie. He asked us, "Hey guys, love the podcast so far. I've been wondering what your relationships to the series were before you started the podcast. Are any of you reading the books for the first time? If you had read them before, when was it, and what impact did they have on you? Did any of you read the books for the first time as children or young adults? Do you wish you had? Thanks, Kenny." Thank you, Kenny. That's a
yes,
really good
thank you.
Question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So who wants to boot Joanne? I'm going to boot this off.
Go first.
Sure. Okay. So this is not my first time reading this series, but it has been such a long time. I really feel like I'm rereading it. Like my mind can only remember, like the sieve of my mind can only remember the really big pieces. And so as we were reading through this, it was really rediscovering it. It was really new for me. I also know that the first time I read this, my children were all very small. And so a lot of that, having read it, a lot of it sort of went in one ear and kind of out the other, necessity wise. Like I, you know, so rereading this has been a really great experience for me. I think one of the things I probably would have really loved to have been able to read this as a young adult, not a child. I think that there's a level to this and a complexity to this that being older helps. Maybe you read it once when you're little and then you reread it when you're older to try to get all of it. But I, you know, I also then think maybe just wait. But I do kind of wish as a young adult in high school, I would have been able to read this. Partly because I think it would have helped me to understand, you know, when people are so visceral, they react so viscerally to this series. And yet there's no reaction like that at all when you think of C.S. Lewis and you think of the Narnia series, which that allegory is total, like, pro-Bible. It's, you know, Aslan is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it is so blatantly clear. And there aren't people up in arms. You know, there aren't atheists up in arms saying, I can't believe you're forcing this down our children's throats. You know, people read it and they enjoy it. And so I think I would have loved to have read it as a young adult just to sort of be immersed in the controversy. That's just sort of who I was mm-hmm. when I was, you mm-hmm. know, but I would have loved to have been able to have those conversations and kind of, you know, coming up from the belt and just like, you know, feeling that way and fighting for this book. So yeah, I mean, I think I would have liked to have read it then, but I appreciate who I am now being able to read these books. Because what I can, you know, how I've changed the things that I used to think and believe and what I do now, this, you know, reading it this time around at my age right now, it is like perfection for sure.
Alaric, what about you?
I came to the series about 15 years after it was published. 1995 was the first book, and I started reading these in 2010. And I went to the store, Barnes & Noble. Remember, there used to be bookstores? And yeah. There still are a few. And I went in and I was like, I want to read this. And I bought all three books all at once. And I had sort of been someone who had fallen out of faith. This isn't what drew me to the material necessarily, but I knew that there was some subtext in the book. Again, I hadn't read it yet. And I, someone who was, grew up Methodist and was, consider myself, I got confirmed, man. I went through the whole thing. But as I got older, I started, wasn't really sure how I felt about things and, you know, the way that religion was used politically and how it was wielded politically was disconcerting. And, I had read a little bit about these books and I thought, I love fantasy and I love things that make me think. And I love The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I like things that have allegory and interesting things going on. So I came to it with that lens and I read the first book incredibly quickly. It's a very rapid read. And I was sort of telling my wife about how good it was. And when I moved on to The Subtle Knife, I handed her Golden Compass, said, you got to read this. Great. This is in 2010. And I started Subtle Knife. And before I finished Subtle Knife, she's like sitting there staring at me, waiting for me to be done with the book because she finished and she was ready to go to the next one. So she read it like right behind me. I think it transcends the sort of fantasy. There's so much going on in this, and we've talked about it in the podcast a lot. I don't think I am prone to hyperbole, but I think it might be the best trilogy I've ever read. It was overwhelming when I read it initially, and coming at it as an adult, I didn't have a chance to read it as a kid, or even as a very young adult. You know, I was already, you know, a little bit older, almost 35. You know. It was transporting in a way that sometimes books can be. And it was, overwhelming and a stunning achievement and thrilling and coming to it again, reading it now for the second time. It's just the layers are maybe because I'm a little bit older. Maybe it's because I've changed. Maybe I've learned more about the book and more about Philip Pullman, and I've read other books and how influential this book is and this series is. It's really special to me. And you know, my daughter's name is Lyra. You know, there's no greater honor than to pass that name on, you know, to, you know, my family is now going to carry a piece of this book with them at all times. So it's really special to me.
So I read this book, I guess I was in my 20s. I was working in downtown DC at the time, and I too used to go to a bookstore.
A what?
A bookstore, a place where they sold these things, these little square pieces of paper. And I'd always stop at a Borders on the way home. I think it was like at 17th and L, I think. And on my way to the metro every day. And this was around a period when I was reading a bunch of James Morrow books. I don't know if you guys know James Morrow. He's one of my favorite authors. He's from State College, Pennsylvania. And he's all of his work was about, you know, questioning the existence of God. I read Only Begotten Daughter, which was phenomenal. The Eternal Only Begotten Daughter may not have been out at that point. Bible Stories for Adults, actually at that point, was really good. And The Eternal Footman, This Is the Way the World Ends was one of the first books that ever made me cry. So, you know, I'd kind of gotten through most of his library at that point, and I was looking for something else similar. And then I somebody recommended, The Golden Compass to me, and so I picked it up. I read a good portion of it in the bookstore. I just sat down. I just started reading, took it home, and kind of burned through it, you know, twice. And loved the heck out of it, and then got the rest of them and read those. So again, this is my early to mid 20s, and as I'm rapidly approaching my mid 40s, it's been about 20 years since last I've read these books. So a lot of this is kind of fresh to me. You know, I've read a couple of books since then. So the water's a bit muddied, and it's nice to have all of this kind of come back to me. It's really nice of you to suggest the possibility that I may have read this as a child. I'm really honored, and it's very obvious you have not yet seen a picture of me yet. But I do. I wish I'd read this when I was younger, because I feel like this would have been, to me, what the Dune series is to me now. Something that I come back to every couple of years just to see what I'm pulling from it. So thanks, Kenny. Anyone else who has questions or things that they'd like to bring up or talk to us about, please feel free to send us an email at feedback@theamberspodcast.com. I promise to make sure that we check our mailbox a lot more often.
Yeah, like, did we miss anything? Do you have a different take on something? Like, anything you want to throw at us, so we'd love to chat about it.
Yeah, and on that same note, we are in the midst. Actually, our YouTube channel is up. You can actually listen to the shows and comment as you listen and watch. You won't be able to see us for the first few, maybe six or seven shows. But afterwards, you'll get to see the recordings that we put together every week, the video. So you can come and watch the show with us and make comments as you go on. You just go to YouTube and search for The Amber Spycast.
Well, thank you guys for listening. The Golden Compass journey has come to an end. The next stop is the Subtle Knife. I'm on record as saying this is my favorite of the three, but we'll see if it holds up. I find it to be pretty exciting. We'll see. I'm excited. Yeah. I think we'll probably end up once we get to the show's premiere, because I don't know if we'll finish the Amber Spot or the, I don't know if we'll finish Subtle Knife before it premieres, but we will try to space them out and figure out a way to do that. Our little brains are going to be working overtime when that happens.
I have to do math.
Well, we appreciate everyone listening. We love doing this first book, and it was fun to talk about the flick. And we're on to the next. Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.
See you later.